So, hello everybody. My name is Héctor Romojaro. I work here at the BU in the Learn team. And I want to talk to you about using GitLab CI pipelines on development on OpenECS. But in reality, I want to talk to you about what to do with a relatively old instance, with a relatively old code base from the early 2000s, and how to put it up to shape with the modern technologies of continuous integration and so on. So, Leonard Beu was already introduced, so I will skip this slide and take you to a trip to 2016. Back in the day, we had a code base that was, in the beginning, imported from CVS, so it was a CVS checkout, as it was common back then. There was no upstream merging. Package upgrades were performed occasionally, and there was local development that went that made the code base diverge over time from the original upstream code. As you can see in this very accurate graph, this happened over time up to, let's say, 2016. At a certain point in time, CVS was replaced locally with Git. And also in upstream, we have a new GitHub, or new back in the day, GitHub Mirror, which is makes things easier, as we will see next. But in general, the problem with this divergence that increased over time is that it made more complex to integrate from the community, bug fixes, features, security fixes, performance, and so on. Also, back in the day, we used to run the automated tests manually, which was suboptimal. So we wanted to have some kind of way to run this automatically, as it should be nowadays, and to merge packages from upstream easier. So this is the size in 2016, calculated using git diff and ignoring the catalog files, the message keys, Ajax helper, spaces, local packages, and so on. This is more or less how it was. In the core, we had 5,514 files that were different from upstream. And in non-core packages, there were more than 4,000. So it was quite some difference over the time. I mean, it is around 14 years of local development here, with some imports from upstream, but still, it's quite a lot. So the challenge was to reduce this divergency to the minimum necessary, and in the meantime, find a way to avoid this in the future. So we could integrate OpenECS upstream code efficiently using these GitHubs, OpenECS repository, as I mentioned, as a remote for our Git repositories. We would have two remotes, one local remote and one and the GitHub remote. So we could import new upstream codes, new upstream code relatively easily, and trying to keep history of both, let's say, worlds. We have the local history with our local commits that went on over the years. We don't want to lose that. And also, we would like to keep the upstream history locally, so we could access both and see why things were made this way, or possible issues, and things like that. That way, we could increase software quality. That's also a topic here. Regarding CI, we want to introduce, or we wanted to introduce, a way to run the automated tests automatically for every single commit, and to try to decrease the duplicity, redundancy with code upstream, and avoid basically that divergency, reduce it, and avoid making it too complicated to do so. So the solution we found was to use two Git remotes, first of all, to unify the code base. That is not here, but it's also a topic. We had different services running different code bases. This is also, as far as I know, a common scenario with OpenECS installations out there. we wanted to unify everything in one single code base and then maintain only that code base. For that code base, using two Git remotes, as I said, one for the local code, which is origin in our case, and the other one for upstream code, which would be GitHub or whatever. For this, we need to mimic or to match upstream's GitHub structure of the OpenACS repositories, which is one repository for ACS Core and multiple repositories for each of the non-core packages. So back in the day, we used to have one single Git repository, which is a relatively common thing as well, including non-core and core, non-core, core, plus local packages. And we wanted to split this into non-core packages and one ACS Core repository, including the local packages. That would be the easiest way for us. So for this, we had to put some effort on trying to, in all repositories, do the initial merge. So we created two remotes, one for GitHub, one for local, and then we had local copy. And then we tried to merge the upstream branches on our code, on our local branches. For this, we had to, for each repository, we had to find, first of all, which was the common ancestor, which was the upstream branch that was more similar to the downstream branch. For this one, we used git diff, basically. And then once this ancestor is identified, then do the first merge, which is the more complicated one, trying to fix the conflicts. And then from then on, next merges are easier for, let's say, the initial merge would be, let's say, 5.5. And then for the next versions up to 5.10, merges are way easier because conflicts are already resolved. So I mentioned that the non-core packages upstream are managed in different repositories. In order to have control over such amount of repositories, we use a tool called MyRepos, which allows to run Git commands or any other command, for the matter, to all repositories at once. This is useful for creating new branches, moving into branches, pooling, and so on and so on. And we also used a GitLab local instance. GitLab offers the possibility to download they have this omnibus distribution where you can just install a local GitLab instance and then run it as you wish. And we took the chance to take advantage of the pipeline mechanism on GitLab and run pipelines, executing tests, and so on, which would make our life easier also for early detection of errors and running automatically tests whenever there is a commit and so on. So this is the structure I was talking about. We have here the repository or the branches of the remote GitHub repository. So we have one for the core, and then n, which in our case is 66, for every non-core package. And all of them have their upstream branches, so OSS 5.10, OSS 5.9, and so on and so forth. And we have here our local remote, which has the integration branch, or the branches, but mostly for this is the most important for this is the integration branch. And the idea is to have a local copy where both remotes can be accessed, so we could have access to the history and the commits of the upstream branches, plus our integration branches and development branches. So in that way, all history is preserved, all history can be accessed easily from the developer point of view in the same local copy and so on. For our workflow, we merge into integration all development. And at the same time, daily, we merge upstream new commits from upstream in the same branch. So this is the directory structure of the whole thing. We have the ACS core repository, which includes the core packages plus plus local packages with no upstream counterpart. We have here what we call the super repository, which only stores the MyRepos configuration and the GitLab CI configuration. This is a handy way to have it everywhere. And we have one repository per non-core package. So, entering GitLab then. GitLab is a web-based DevOps lifecycle tool. I think it's relatively common. Probably most of you know it. It has some, it's a Git repository manager with includes some web IDE. It's free software, it's free software, but with an open core development model. So, and it allows also to have private repositories and the regular thing, groups, forks, permissions. It provides with some stats. And it can be installed on premises. And it provides also with these integrated CI/CD mechanisms. And we will focus only on the pipeline for this. So basically, the idea is that every change in the integration branch triggers the pipeline. And then the pipeline is run by what they call GitLab runners, which execute every single job in our case, in a container, in a Docker container, with running Navi service. If any of the jobs fails, then the pipeline stops, and then the cleanup phase is triggered, and then developers have to go and check what happened there. So for our case, the internals of one particular job. So as I mentioned before, they are run by runners, what they call GitLab runners, on Docker containers with Navi server. We do have a shared Postgres instance where there is a pool of databases that can be used for the jobs. We do reserve one single database per pipeline, so it's easier. And because in the end, rebuilding databases is costly, so we want to avoid it if possible. So we want to reuse the same database for the pipeline, for each pipeline, so to say. How to run these tests, or how to run OpenACS code from GitLab or from the pipeline jobs? We use scripts called CI, also named CI something something, that are on www, and it can be accessed via curl. And the output is produced by NSWrite. You can see on the right here more or less how the automated testing of production safe tests look into the GitLab interface. And then the results can be grabbed from the server logs easily using grep to check if for messages using maybe a prefix, let's say CI tests, to check for particular problems, or to check for particular data, or just to know if the job was successful or not. And it produces artifacts. Artifacts are basically files that are produced for in jobs that can be reused in a later stage, or they can be downloaded via the interface. So as artifacts, we produce the error log, and we produce a small file called rebuild.db in case the database needs to be rebuilt, which is something, as I mentioned before, that we want to avoid if possible. So, stages. These are the stages of a typical pipeline that we run. Let's say there is a commit in the integration branch, somebody makes a push, and then this is triggered. And we have a build stage where the database is reserved for this pipeline. The source tree is put in there by using my repos. And then the first stage is the test coverage. As Professor Neumann mentioned before in the initial OpenACS 5.10 talk, there is a new API for test coverage. There are new pages for test coverage, and we take advantage of this information and include it in the pipeline. And then there are package upgrade checks. Then we have the regular automated tests, catalog import, blah 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 blah. I will go through them in detail right now. So, for the build stage, we do the retrieval of the source tree using my repos. We reserve a database. The database we're using, we want to be as close as production as possible. But the data, the production database is relatively large, and for rebuilding, it would take some time. So in order to take the best of both worlds, more or less, we use a thinned out production database, which is around 270 gigabytes and takes, let's say, 20 minutes to rebuild, which is a relatively fine time. There is a pool of databases with a naming convention that we use for taking the free databases from. So you have GitLab pipeline free one, for instance, and then when it's reserved, it's renamed to GitLab pipeline and the ID of the pipeline. So it can be easily accessed if there is something wrong or if somebody wants to check the results of the tests or something that happened there, one can access the database if the pipeline is canceled. And for concurrency for the database regeneration and reservation, we use tags for the GitLab runners. It's possible to set certain tags for the runner. We use one called DB mutex, which is a sort of a cheap mutex mechanism to have only one runner doing database operations, like reserve the database or regenerate the database. So the coverage stage. The new coverage is basically amounting for the number of public procs covered by automated tests. This is done by package and globally. As many of the stages here can be done by package or globally. If they are called on a non-core repository, they would start with package tests, package coverage, package catalog import, package upgrade, and then go into global. Aside from retrieving the coverage for the next iteration of the pipeline, it fails if this coverage decreases. So this is also a way to enforce policy here. So let's say we have a coverage of 69, and then somebody makes a commit, and then maybe creating a new public proc, but maybe this public proc doesn't have any tests. So the coverage would decrease, and this would make the pipeline fail. This is one way to enforce people making automated tests, and also create some complaints from people. So for this, we used, as I mentioned before, in OpenSSH 5.10, we have this new API for the coverage, and we have this redesigned proc coverage page. So upgrades. We test the upgrade of a single package and all other packages. This stage will fail if there is a dependency error or an unsuccessful upgrade. So basically, if the upgrade itself is producing errors, we will fail that stage and therefore the whole pipeline. If an upgrade is performed, then this taints the database, which is basically producing this artifact rebuild DB that will be used then afterwards in the cleanup phase in order to rebuild the database. If there is no upgrade, well, so far there is no need to rebuild the database, so we will continue that way. For the API that we're using is basically the APM package, whatever, and APM scan packages in order to get the test. So the message catalog import. This is a relatively recent stage that we introduced. It imports the message catalog files of a single or all possible packages, and it's run after the packages upgrade. The idea is that it will detect conflicts and changes, like adding a new message key, deleting a new message key, updating a new message key. And it would fail if such changes or conflicts are detected without a package upgrade. As this is run after the package upgrade stage, any change would make this fail. It's a cheap way to detect if somebody modified the message keys without creating, without incrementing the version number of the packets. This is problematic for releases. So let's say one wants to make a release and then goes to the APM, updates the packages, but suddenly, oh, the message keys are not there, or some changes in the message keys are not there because somebody forgot to increment the version number of the package. This happened, and that's why we implemented this. It also attains the database if any change is performed, triggering a rebuild of the database. And for the API, it's basically the ACS-Lang API. You have the catalog import and the conflict count for messages. And now for the ACS automated testing stages. So this basically runs the tests on the ACS automated testing suite on a single or all possible packages. And it fails if any single test fails. This, of course, taints the database if non-production safe tests are run. Production safe, we are using that category of tests to avoid rebuilding the database. So these production safe tests should be tests that shouldn't have any side effects on the database level, hopefully. Yeah. And we are using this relatively new API, ACS test user, to create testing users that run the tests. It's really helpful because some tests, we are calling the CI scripts from curl from the outside. I mean, in the end, we want to avoid any logging mechanism, any kind of extra layer of complexity here. So we use this ACS test user API in order to create an ad hoc test user and run the tests at such. For the API, we use the AA run series to run the test, and one can get the test cases using accessing the NSB AA test. And then to finish the stages with the cleanup one, I think I mentioned all these before. Basically, it restores or rebuilds the database aside from deleting the source tree if the database is not tainted, so we don't get this rebuilddb artifact. Then we just put it back in the pool and reuse it for the next pipeline, which is very cheap. Just rename the database, and that's it. If it's tainted, then we recreate it from the template DB, and it would take some minutes. And we manage the concurrency with this DB mutex run, yeah, that I mentioned before. And this is basically the present now. So we unified the code base. We merge against upstream. We are using different remotes. We are using my repos to manage all the repositories, 60-something repositories. And we use GitLab for the CI pipelines. So what we have in the end is that all is a continuous delivery sort of scenario where all work is committed into the integration branch, including the latest upstream code, which is merged daily. It's very quick, the daily merge, because normally, there are no conflicts. If there are conflicts, they can be easily resolved because there will be few commits from that day. And every push to the integration branch triggers the pipeline. And this is this metro line graph is more or less our development cycle. Our development cycle is around 2 weeks to produce our release. We have we take the code from GitHub here, we merge it or cherry pick it, depending on the integration branch. We have our development branches here that also commit into the integration branch. And then every week, more or less, or every 2 weeks, sorry, this goes into the production branch. Then there is a testing phase where some changes can be cherry picked. If bugs are found, which are, or things can be validated by other people there. And then during the release phase, these are pushed to the proper production branch and pulled into the live instance. And this takes around 2 weeks in total. And we have release times, let's say every 2 weeks, for less than, the whole release can take less than 1 hour, normally, maybe less. And there is almost no downtime. It's around, let's say, 20, 30, 40 seconds downtime, in the worst case. But yeah, it's quite normal, let's say. And this is it. I put you here some unnecessary links to things that you already know. Maybe my repos. But yeah, there you go. And this is it. I'm open for questions.
Thank you for the great presentation. My first question is, how do you detect if a proc is covered by the coverage tests?
The proc is covered, so during the server start, it is declared which procs are covered by the tests. So each test declares which proc is covering, which part of the API is covering. And then there is an NSB with all of these that you can access to it. This is what the API does in the end. The test itself is declaring which part of the API is covering. So a particular proc or a web page.
And on the other way around, you you take the, I would say, the source code, and you detect each proc command, and you have to cover all that, or that's your percentage, or
this
how do
is
you find
done
all
in
the
API in the API doc.
Yeah.
Right
okay.
Now, so one can go to a particular proc and see the tree of calls from that. Mm-hmm. But then is the question of what can be considered covered. So if one call to a particular proc is counts as this test is covering that proc, or is just one particular call that maybe, you know, maybe it's just calling it with a particular parameter that is could not be considered covered by the test.
Just a short comment. I mean, when you when you're defining a proc, you define is this part of the public API or not. If this is not normal tickle, this is some more annotation. And by this afterwards, you can afterwards, this just all of the functions which are loaded are also kept in memory in this NSVs, in these shared variables, and it can at any time, from this package, how many things are the public API and where is used. And if some other package calls a non-public API, you can also determine it. I mean, we have that it's happening simply via a source code beautifier, which looks to the code and looks what is this program calling. In the same way as you're highlighting what is the called functions, you also realize this function is calling this other function and it does it. I mean, the complicated part is the namespace resolution and such things, but I mean, it's working quite okay.
Sorry, I have another question. You use TCL MSG Cut for your message catalogs or another solution?
No, it's the OpenACS message key catalog.
Okay, and that goes to MSG Cut or?
No.
Okay, thank you.
It's in the same line that his question, and I guess it will answer, I believe, his questions about it.
Okay.
Let's say that how do you deal with content that has been created by a user in the testing phase?
With that?
Does the test covers the content repository? I believe so.
The test calls?
The test treats the if let's say that a user has, in the test phases,
yeah,
you create a content,
yeah,
a user content related.
Yeah.
So the whole thing will be erased no matter what, because content repository has been supported in the tests.
So there is this thinned out database that we use for the pipelines. This also includes a content repository.
That's it. So core AG procs will be all treated in the same testing phase.
We have two things. One is the testing phase of the release cycle, which is can take up to 1 week. And this includes fixing bugs, blah, 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 but it's more on the software engineering side. And then we have the tests themselves, the automated tests or the pipeline itself that is triggered for every single commit. For this particular pipeline, we are using a database that is a thinned out version of the production database. And this includes a thinned out version of the content repository. So user content is tested there up to a certain degree.
Okay, and the other question is, I know some people from Los Angeles that would love to get the Docker container for mm-hmm. Postgres installation. Mm-hmm. So is that available somewhere?
I mean, we thought about going that way. But for our case, it's easier to have just a single Postgres instance that everybody can access, everybody can check, and is shared among all the containers.
Okay, I'm going to get the information. Then I can forward to them.
Okay. Okay, thanks.